From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, three ex-offenders share how they believe the treatment system is broken and how to fix it. One says it starts with coping skills.
If you're going to clean your house, you got to replace it with something. And I used to tell friends that were trying to fight that you got to have something to do at 2:30 in the morning when you're watching people going to the dope house down the street. What you going to do other than look out the window?
We'll consider the legend and legacy of John Wayne. And a woman who hikes the Great Lakes says we're pretty lucky right here.
People in Wisconsin should know that you have a wonderful stretch of fairly sandy beach between Kohler Andre and Harrington State Park. So between those two parks, it's walkable, and not much else is walkable along Wisconsin's shoreline.
Lake Effect comes your way next after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. Our six-month Project Milwaukee series on the high rate of incarceration among Milwaukee's African-American men is nearing its conclusion. Last week, we featured a town hall forum in which people from the community and decision makers talked about potential solutions to breaking the cycle of incarceration that affects many men in the community. One of the organizations that came up in that discussion was Project Return. It's headquartered on Milwaukee's Near North Side and provides support and assistance for men trying to reintegrate into society after leaving prison. Not long ago, we met three men for whom Project Return has played a role, and they talked all at great length about where they believe the system comes up short and how they think things could be different. At the top of today's show, we'll hear a few minutes from each of them. Troy Hawkins spent time behind bars for sexual assault of a teenager. Given the nature of his crime, he concedes few people are sympathetic to his difficulties in finding work in the community.
We were at Project Return's anniversary a few months ago, and I got up there and spoke and said that I was a sex offender and, you know, how the Department of Correction didn't allow me to go to church services, you know, and some of the things we just talked about, and how I was clean and sober, I was going to school, I was working full-time at the time. In April last month, I was just able to vote for the first time in 8 years. And the lady stood in line with a few people that wanted to come up and congratulate me, I thought, and several people said, I'm glad that you've turned your life around and you're no longer a detriment and causing harm to society. We like that. And this lady stood there at the end of the line, and she said that she was a victim, and she despised me. She said that she was a sexual assault victim when she was younger, and she really didn't give a damn about me. And the only thing I told her that I appreciated, you know, her frankness, but the only thing I can do is to try to straighten my life out so that I can effectively help someone else. That's all I can do. I voted for the first time last month. I didn't get to vote in 2008 in the presidential election when Barack Obama was elected because I was out of prison, but I was still on supervision. So I can vote now, and so I can educate other people about the importance of voting. I can show up at town hall hearings and find out what's going on in my community. I can show up at the neighborhood meetings, which I do, and inform other people the importance of it. And so the only thing I can do is try to let my life be a light and show them that there is possible for people to turn their lives around and make better after getting out of prison. That's all I can do.
If you were going to fix the system in some either small way or big way, where would you start?
Okay, therein lies, now that I'm off supervision, when I was on supervision, I couldn't have any contact with anyone under 18. But I felt that I had a lot to offer to young men, 14, 15, 16-year-old young boys. So my pastor wants me to put together some program working with young teenage boys. So I don't know about fixing the system. That's too big. But I know if I can educate a 14-year-old and talk about the consequences of his actions, carrying a gun, the detriment of selling drugs to the community, the destruction that it causes, how it's important to pull up your pants because the image that you project decides whether or not you're going to get a job, tattooing your body, how ridiculous it is, and trying to get that education. In Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, it's over 50% dropout rate for high school students. And I see these kids in my neighborhood all the time, standing around with their pants sagging, smoking weed, and they're potential candidates to end up in the House of Correction, MSDF, and Dodge, and in the prison system. So if you can get them at 14 years old in middle school before they get to high school to make a conscious decision that they want to live a better lifestyle, make better choices, and end up in college and graduate high school, you can eliminate a lot of people ending up in the Department of Corrections.
Troy Hawkins served time for sexual assault of a minor. He believes treatment programs he's found through Project Return and other organizations have been more effective than those mandated by the state. Truman Schumpert says the same holds true for him, though in his case, it's a drug habit he's been trying to kick throughout the four decades he's been in and out of prison on charges like burglary, car theft, and forgery. He says the tools offered through the Department of Corrections, AODA, alcohol and other drug abuse treatment, came up short.
They tell you you got to change, but they don't stress this as a lifestyle change. They just say you got to change. Okay, say you like chewing gum, and it's bad for your teeth and all that. They don't tell you it's a lifestyle. You got to quit it, and you got to work something else in it. In the Bible, and I hate to bring this up like that, but they say if you're going to clean your house, you got to replace it with something. And I used to tell friends that were trying to fight that something that you got to do something. You got to have something to do at 2:30 in the morning when you're watching people going to the dope house down the street. What you going to do other than look out the window? What can you do that'll come to mind?
Oversimplifying things to say that the treatment was well-intentioned but not really practical?
Yes, and that's not oversimplifying. That's hitting the nail on the head. So the weapons they gave me to combat those triggers weren't valid. It's just like Nancy Reagan saying, just say no. It sounds good in theory. But all the other parameters that make you make the decision, stomp on that just say no theory. Everybody knows that now. You know, I don't care what the trigger is. It don't have to be drugs. It could be gambling, pornography, excuse me for bringing that up. Whatever, a smart drug user will get to the philosophic point. Everybody has got a habit that they shouldn't be doing. Some can publicize it, some can't, for whatever reasons. But everybody got one. Mine happened to be drugs. So why you put a stigma on mine and not the rest of them? They don't have no real stigma on gambling. Yeah, they tell you you're going to lose your house and your family and all that, finance and material things, but it ain't no big stigma on that. But drugs? Oh, plague of the world or whatever, which could be. I'm not disagreeing with that. It's bad. I understand that. Note that I have used some of the things that I've learned from the programs to help me in my fight against this disease, which is, they say, is baffling and cunning, and it is. But all the bad habits are.
Have you gotten better at it?
Yeah, but this is how smart I thought I was. When I first realized I had a habit, I said, let me go to a drug treatment place, find out the solution. When this get too bad for me, I'll whip the solution out and I'll be all right. I can keep on going. It didn't work like that.
So do you think it's up to the individual and the individual's family and friends? Or if you are going to make this better, is there something more
treatment wise?
Yeah, the state should be doing. The corrections system should be doing.
Yes. For some reason, and this is cross country states, not cross country, but most of the country, states don't want inmates to have access to the internet. Why? Like we just gonna directly go to the porn site in jail, or the dope site, or the crime site, whatever that is. Come on. They monitor the situation anyway. So what's the deal with that? But now if we did have access to it, they have those modules where you can go through yourself where you don't need a, what they call, facilitator. You know what I'm saying? And if you subscribe to that, you're going to have more input into it because this is what you want to do. Not just that, but there's more than one way to skin a cat, okay? So you can have the modules and a computer site, whatever it costs for the module, and then you got it for life.
You're saying people can access the help they need.
By themselves.
Truman Shumpert speaking about what he sees as shortcomings in alcohol and drug treatment programs in the prison system. We spoke with one other person who's being helped by the services of Project Return. Bob asked that his last name not be used. He served time in the county jail for a sex offense and fears the impact the revelation would have on his current employment. He's also white, but says his race is irrelevant in the context of the shortcomings he sees in the system for treating people like him.
There was nothing in the jail. I mean, I was actually serving my sentence in the jail system. There wasn't any support. The support that they had in place came after I left the jail. I was required to participate in it's called SOT, which is Sex Offender Treatment Program, and I was participating in it the entire time I was on probation. And it was based on a pretty much a fear factor issue. It's like if you talk to people, it's like, well, you know, if you go to court, you can do a lie detector test or something to prove you're innocent. Well, lie detector tests aren't accepted in the court of law, but they're accepted and used every day in the Department of Corrections. So you can do something, and you pay to take the lie detector test. You have to pay for it as part of your treatment, and you can pass it the way you're supposed to pass it and by answering the questions truthfully, but you can still be failed because they don't like your answers.
Well, and you say that the treatment was based on fear. What do you mean by that? Fear?
It's like I hate using it as an example, but you know, alcohol, AA. You know, people. If you have a problem, you call a fellow member of your group. You maybe assign somebody as a mentor who's mentoring you, so you have a big brother that you can count on. In the treatment, you can't talk to anybody you're in treatment with. It doesn't matter what the program is. If you're in treatment with something through Department of Corrections, you can't talk to the other people unless you're in the treatment. Or it's grounds for you to be sent back, and then you start over, or you create another case and start over and start over and start over. Or replication is the other word that people might not understand, but means that you pretty much start from scratch, and whatever probation doesn't count, nothing counts.
Did you manage to make it through treatment without?
Yes, I did, but I saw many people who were pulled out. I can give you examples. You go to treatment and the facilitator doesn't like the way a person is answering questions. You get put on the hot seat. We call it that, the first person comes in, because people are scared into telling the truth, I guess you'd say. And they have to take ownership of what they're doing, and they have to admit to what they've done and what put them where they are, and you have to admit to it. And there are cases where people didn't do anything, but they've been forced into it. I'm not saying there are a lot, but there are some. And I've read about them later on. Oh, I knew that guy. It's like, yeah, he was telling the truth all along, but you're forced another way.
If you could wave a magic wand and fix the system, where would you start?
I would get rid of the box on every application in the country that if they want to know who you are and what your abilities are, that's great. They shouldn't have the right, nobody hiring anybody should have the right to have your work history, your life history, a record that's not a full record, until they're ready to offer you a job. And then you can come forward, because then they're talking to you as the person who has the ability to do the work. And anybody that's been locked up, I mean, I don't understand why employers don't understand this. If you want a good worker, hire someone who's been locked up. Guess what? They're never going to be late for work, ever. Especially if they're on probation, because it's a requirement of their probation to be at work, and they have to have a record of them being there and doing a good job. And if they screw up, that's their invitation for them to go back. So if I was an employer, I'd be knocking on doors of any organization that's working with people who've recently been released to find workers who are actually going to show up and do the job. And I'd figure out a way to make sure that they had transportation to get to and from work, because those are people I can count on.
Bob is one of three people we spoke to in the offices of Project Return, an organization that helps ex-offenders reintegrate into society after prison. And you can hear our full Project Milwaukee series at wuwm.com/projectmilwaukee. 35 years after his death, why are Americans still drawn to the story of John Wayne? We'll get some insight when Lake Effect returns on WUWN. More of Lake Effect now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. All right, quick, name an actor known for playing cowboys. Well, you could have said Gary Cooper or Gene Autry or even Clint Eastwood, but the name that likely jumped out at most of you was John Wayne. The legendary actor in such films as The Big Trail, Stagecoach, The Quiet Man, and True Grit died 35 years ago next month, but he still exerts a hold over popular culture and the American psyche. It's the full story of the man whose real name was Marion Morrison that writer and film historian Scott Eyman examines in his exhaustive new biography, John Wayne, The Life and Legend. He'll talk about the book this evening at the Milwaukee Public Market, but first he joins us in the studio. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Happy to be here, Mitch.
The 35th anniversary of John Wayne's death is in just a few weeks, if I'm not mistaken. Why do you think a lifetime after his death, people are still fascinated by this man?
I guess that's the complicated question I was trying to unravel. For one thing, he was lucky in his collaborators. He made over a dozen films with John Ford, four or five films with Howard Hawks, four or five films with Henry Hathaway, the cream of the directorial crop of that generation. And John Ford and Howard Hawks are not going away. That's quite clear, because their movies are about more than the narrative. They're about the nature of America and how we got to where we are and the nature of our vision of ourself. And Wayne became the focus of those directors in terms of their interpretation of the American trek west and what it means to be an American. So because of the density of those films and the longevity of the artists that made them, Wayne has himself lasted far longer than most actors can hope to last once they're dead, because standards of beauty and what we look for in actors are as temporal as fashions, really.
So you're saying if John Wayne had toiled for lesser directors whose movies didn't have the same kind of longevity, he'd be somebody we'd see on the late night movie rerun, but we wouldn't be dissecting what he meant to the to American film the way we do today.
Well, it goes into speculative history. What would Jefferson think of iPhones? But yeah, if you take those 30 films, that bulk of 30 films that he made with the A-list directors of his era, who chose him to be their main dramatic focus as opposed to Gary Cooper or Joel McRae or any of the other actors that were his competition, I think we'd be talking about a much different career. And then also there was the sheer emotional size of the man, his capacity to play either tenderness or savagery. He was very strong in the extreme emotions, and he was also very strong in the middle emotions.
He's also still a symbol as much as anything, isn't he? You still hear Europeans describe American foreign policy in terms of John Wayne movies.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's, I think he'd be surprised about that, because he thought there was a point at which he chose to play certain parts that he wanted to represent, that he meant to represent what he thought of as the national character. He didn't start out that way. He started out as a very insecure, shy child who couldn't talk to the girls that thought he was stunningly handsome because he was just too shy and unsure of himself. But over the years, he accreted a certain self-confidence, and he wanted to feel more of that. So he started to play characters that contained qualities that he wanted for himself. And in so doing, he absorbed those qualities, and he played what he wanted to become.
Well, and one of the points you make in this book is that for all the image he crafted of himself as an accidental movie star, he really had his eye on drama from a fairly young age. What did it say about him that he maintained that sort of creation story for as long as he did?
He was a blue-collar kid. He was a jock. The only way he got into college was by an athletic football scholarship at USC. There was no family money to pay him into any kind of college otherwise. And if there's one thing an early 20th century blue-collar jock couldn't admit to, it was, I want to be an actor. That was just not going to go down well in the huddle. So he to his dying day, he always tried to give the impression that It was just somebody tapped him on the shoulder. The football was laying there. He grabbed it and ran with it. It was just something that happened to him, and he took advantage of it. And that couldn't be further from the truth. From the time he was a kid in Glendale, he moved there when he was 12 or 13, he was a movie-struck kid. He was part of the drama club in high school. He acted in school plays. As soon as he got to Fox as a summer job to help support himself while he was at college at USC, he was started pestering people, put me in movie, put me in movies, use me in this, use me in that. And they told him quite sensibly, you're too big. You're 6'4". All these other actors are 5'8" and 5'9". Six-footers were very unusual in the early 20th century. We can't use you because it'll look like a Mutt and Jeff comedy. So getting parts was very, very difficult for him. But he was always – it was something he always wanted to do. And he was very driven and he was very focused because he came from a his father was something of an ineffectual failure, and he was quite the reverse. He meant to be successful.
There's a really remarkable picture in the photographic collection that's in the middle that I think John Wayne is an extra, and he just towers over everyone.
He's a full head tall. He was 6'3¾", and with normal shoes, he's over 6'4". So, yeah, and in that era, people were just much, much more smaller and more petite. So he was very difficult to cast him.
You mentioned John Ford. Talk about his relationship with John Ford. It started really early in his career. It kind of went by the wayside for a while, but by the end of his career, it was really as important as any of the relationships he had in the film industry.
More important. Ford was not just his father figure. He was Ford was the Michelangelo of John Wayne's career. He saw this block of marble, and he started carving away at it. And that the character that you see starting to take shape in Stagecoach, the first film he starred in for Ford, by the time they made The Searchers and Liberty Valance 25 years later, is a far more complex, far more audacious creation. Wayne regarded Ford as his, not just his father figure, but as the person to whom he owed his career, his life, his home, the bread that he ate. And he would take anything from Ford, and did. I mean, if Ford loved you, he abused you. If Ford really loved you, he abused you terribly. If Ford didn't like you or disliked you, then you didn't exist. He saw right through you, and you weren't in the room. That was pretty much the way John Ford operated.
Well, and there was this whole period where John Wayne had all sorts of roles in all sorts of movies, mainly through the Depression. His success at the end of that period, he came out a different person than the first time John Ford worked with him.
Well, Wayne made a big, audacious 70-millimeter spectacular Western in 1930 called The Big Trail. It was meant to turn him into the next Tom Mix as far as Fox Studios was concerned. Instead, it dropped dead and lost a great deal of money. And Wayne, who had been a rising hot young star at the age of 22, was a washed-up has-been at the age of 23. And for the next 10 years, almost 10 years, he basically had to take whatever he could get. He became a jobbing actor. He made dozens of disposable B-movies, Westerns usually. He got large parts in tiny films and tiny parts in large films. But at the same time, while all this was going on, he was learning his craft. If you look at a John Wayne B-Western from 1932 or 33 and look at a John Wayne B-Western in 1937 and 1938, there's a great difference in his authority, in his concision, in his ability to project character, and in his comfort level with dialogue. Because of the immersion of films, constantly working, he became a much better actor than he had been in 1930. I think I say in the book that he was a born movie star, which he was. He had looks, he had charisma, but he was not a born actor. He had to learn how to be an actor. And those 10 years in the wilderness, which he resented mightily all of his life, actually, those 10 years in the wilderness taught him his craft. Those were the foundation stones of the John Wayne we think of as this monolithic construct. He had to teach himself how to act and how to learn his craft.
Well, and so let's flash forward some decades, because as his star rose, his ability to pick and choose what he involved himself in obviously increased. What was it about The Alamo that made him so adamantly want to make that picture, despite all the forces fighting it and him?
He saw it as the perfect metaphor for what America needed to be. There were 200 odd men inside the Alamo fighting off 10,000 Mexicans, and they fought them off for a long time. And he thought, we ought to be able to do that. We're Americans, damn it. And it became a personal quest for him, partially, I suspect, because so many people objected to it and told him he couldn't do it because he was extremely stubborn and single-minded. And once he set his mind to something, it didn't matter how many people said, you're not going to do it. He just became even more determined to do it. Nobody would finance it with him as director. See, they would happily have financed a film with him acting in the Alamo with anyone, John Ford directing, Howard Hawks directing, William Wellman, Henry Hathaway, all of whom he could have asked to direct the picture, any of whom would have directed the picture. But he was determined to direct it himself because, as he told me when I interviewed him in 1972, I wanted to tell the story my way. Not Jack Ford's way, not Howard Hawks' way, my way. And it cost him a great deal of money, a great deal of prestige.
Sounds like it almost became a metaphor for itself.
It did. It was one of like Apocalypse Now. It was one of those movies about a war, about a catastrophe that was in itself a kind of war and catastrophe.
Duke's last film was The Shootist, which proved to be, again, kind of a metaphor for where John Wayne was at that point in his life.
He was his health was spiraling down as they were making the picture. They had to shut the picture down for 2 weeks. It was extraordinarily difficult to get the picture finished. He caught a cold in Carson City where they were shooting the locations, and he had cancer surgery. He lost a lung to cancer in 1963, and at every point after that, whenever he caught a cold, it was odds on it would turn into bronchitis, possibly turning into pneumonia. And then it was going to be trouble. And that's what happened in Carson City. He caught a cold. It became much worse. And he couldn't breathe. So they had to shut the picture down for 2 entire weeks. And they were never sure for a lot of those two weeks if he was going to be able to come back and make the picture.
Right. They were shooting scenes without him with doubles.
They were shooting the climactic gunfight with doubles because that was the point. They were able to shoot him entering the bar. Where the final shootout takes place, but then he got sick. So they shot the entire sequence with doubles, and it was extraordinarily difficult, and you were obviously losing a lot because you couldn't see his face with all the action going on. But they were worried they were going to have an unreleasable picture on their hands. They had to cobble together something. He pulled it together. He got back to the set. They finished the picture. But he hated the director. The director hated him. It was a pitch battle from day one. It was just one of those pictures that's so incredibly hard to make. But when you see it, it's like water over rocks. It flows. It's a beautiful picture. It's a beautiful, restrained, sober performance. And there's really no sense of the stress and strain that went into it. But he never made another movie because his health continued to deteriorate for the last 2.5 years of his life.
John Wayne's last public appearance was on the Academy Awards broadcast in 1979 when he announced the award for Best Picture. It surprised a lot of people that he was willing to make that appearance when he was really almost dying.
He was dying. He was, in fact, dying. He had radiation treatment for the cancer that morning, got into a van and was driven to the site of the broadcast. He had to lay down. His strength was waning. He'd lost already at that point 40 pounds. He looked very thin. He had to have a new tuxedo fitted because his old tuxedo hung on him. And he was clearly had cancer and wasn't going to make it. But he had promised to award the Best Picture award, and he kept his promises despite everything. And he had to rehearse walking down the steps of the set because his strength was really not there. So he had to build himself up emotionally and physically and psychologically for those 2 minutes or 3 minutes that he was on camera. And when he showed up backstage, everybody was shocked because they hadn't seen him and they didn't know to what extent his health had been affected by his illness. But it became obvious. And everybody wanted to see him and tell him how happy they were to see him. Jane Fonda was there, who was a childhood friend because he had been very close with Henry Fonda when they were both in the John Ford stock company. Laurence Olivier was there. I think he got an honorary Oscar that year, and he wanted to see Wayne. I mean, everybody congregated, and it was the last time he appeared in public.
You say, as you mentioned, you had the chance to interview John Wayne back in 1972. How introspective was he at the time you spoke with him?
He was who he seemed to be on the screen, but he was somebody else as well. he was huge physically and emotionally. His emotional size really did fill the room. And he was very intimidating, except he put you at ease very quickly. Within 5 minutes, you were just having a conversation. There was no, oh, my God, I'm talking to John Wayne. He's going to kill me. He was much calm. He was very calm. He was reflective. He was contemplative. If you asked him a serious question, he'd think about it and give you a serious answer. There was nothing rote about, and this is a guy who'd been interviewed, you know, 50,000 times. And I had no business interviewing him. I was a 21-year-old kid with almost no credentials. But he was.
How did you happen to get that interview?
I wrote him a letter. And his secretary wrote me back and said, well, if you're out here, I was living in Ohio at the time. She said, if you're out here, I'll do my best to hook you up. And I showed up in California, Hollywood, about 8 weeks later, 8, 9 weeks later, called her. She said, well, he's shooting a TV show at CBS. He's got plenty of time. Show up at 1 o'clock. So I did, and he was in his dressing room, and he had nothing to do. It was CBS was shooting a salute to CBS, basically. 50 glorious years of CBS. So Lucille Ball was there, and Jack Benny was there, and Bob Hope was there, and a bunch of people who had nothing to do with CBS, but they were just the great stars of that generation. And John Wayne was among them, and he was sitting in his dressing room, and every 20 minutes or so, somebody would stick their head in and say, we're not quite ready for you, Mr. Wayne. And he said, that's okay. I'm with my friend here. And we talked for 90 minutes, and I asked him questions about John Ford and Hawks, and I didn't ask him about cancer. I didn't ask him about politics. We talked strictly about movies, and what I didn't understand at the time, but I came to understand later after talking to more people that were similar to him, is that he was a journeyman picture man, by which I mean most people in the movies love the money of the movies. They love the fame of the movies, the publicity. You get good tables at restaurants, all that. They don't really like the work because it's not a lot of fun. You act for 30 seconds. You wait for half an hour. You act for a minute. You wait for 2 hours while they set the camera and the lights. Wayne loved the process. He loved being on a set. He loved joshing with the stuntman. He loved running lines with actors. He liked working with young actors who were inexperienced and helping them get their craft the way older actors had once helped him get his craft. He liked getting there at 7 in the morning. He liked everything about the process. And very few people are like that. He loved the process. In fact, he was a workaholic. I think a movie set was his home, was the place where he felt most comfortable and most himself. And for that reason, you know, his marriages were often compromised because after 3 or 4 weeks, he'd start to get restless about being at home because he wasn't working. And he was also a depression kid. His family was poor, so it was important for him psychologically to be working, to have the money coming in, because he was always worried about money, and he always wanted to be wealthy, and he wasn't really.
It's a fascinating read. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Happy to do it, Mitch. Thank you.
Scott Eyman's new book is called John Wayne, The Life and Legend. He'll talk about the American icon this evening at an event at the Milwaukee Public Market. Another break now, and then the second book in a trilogy about hiking around the Great Lakes. That's when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Michigan native Lorene Neuenheis has loved the Great Lakes forever, but says it was a midlife crisis that morphed her fondness to exploring them and writing about them. Neuenheis decided she had to do something, quote, so large she just might fail. She hiked successfully the perimeter of Lake Michigan and wrote a book about it. Then there was no stopping her. Neuenheis went on to craft a book about hikes on all 5 Great Lakes. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz met up with her earlier this month on Milwaukee's Lake Michigan shore. Neuenheis was on her way to Lake Superior's Isle Royal. It will figure into another book, this time, you guessed it, on Great Lakes Islands. When they met, Neuenheis was about to release her first ebook on her 10 favorite hikes on Lake Michigan.
Well, each adventure has seemed to lead to the next. With my first adventure of hiking around Lake Michigan, I thought the next adventure should include all 5 Great Lakes. So I spent time on the shorelines of all 5 Great Lakes. And during that adventure, I made it to some of the islands. I hiked Gros Isle in the Detroit River. I spent some time on Mackinac Island. And the more I thought about the islands, the more I thought they're kind of a regional thing. People here know about Washington Island. People in Michigan will talk about Beaver Island or Mackinac Island, but very few people know about Manitoulin Island because it's Canadian, or the Thousand Islands in the St. Lawrence River. And I have a question for you. How many islands are in the Great Lakes Basin?
You know, I don't know.
Over 30,000. So just that fact alone blows people's minds, you know?
Wow.
So I'm not getting to all the islands.
Come on, Lorreen.
But I'll kayak some of them. I've already done some kayaking. I'll kayak the Apostle Islands this year.
Oh, neat.
With my niece and nephew. They're coming along. And they're city folk from Atlanta, so it's going to be fun to get them out into the wild a little bit. That will be in July. Hopefully the lake will be free of ice by then.
So you're heading off to?
To Grand Portage, Minnesota, to catch the ferry to go out to Isle Royale, where I'm helping with the moose wolf study. We will be hiking on the island for a week with the researchers, gathering moose bones and taking them back to the researchers.
Wow.
I know. It's going
to be
freezing.
Is that a connection that you made when you did your last book?
When I decided to do the islands, I started looking at which islands I definitely had to get to. So Isle Royale was on that list. And then when I found out, well, I had known about the moose wolf study. It's been going on for over 50 years now. 50. It's in its 56th year. Yeah. It's the longest running predator prey study ever done. And then when I found out they needed people with hiking experience to spend a week on the island gathering moose bones, I'm like, I'm in.
I can walk.
Yeah.
I can find things.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
And then what's next?
After Isle Royale.
Survey work. Yeah.
Well, I'll continue doing islands throughout this year, finishing islands in Lake Superior, Lake Huron, and Lake Ontario.
Cool.
And that will be the basis for the next book, which comes out in 2015 in the spring.
Oh, wow. You already have a deadline.
Oh, yeah.
Is that your deadline or your publisher's deadline?
We kind of agree on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's nice that two lakes are already done and that part of the manuscript is already at my publisher with my editor, so he's working on it right now, and he'll get it back to me, and I'll continue revising it.
This study that you're helping will figure into your book as well.
Certainly,
yeah.
And when I was on the Manitou Islands, I helped with the piping plover research. And that's an endangered shorebird, and that's some of the hardest work I've ever done. And I've renovated houses and, you know, torn down garages, but watching these little birds and walking slowly, I am a long distance. I was working with a naturalist on North Manitou. I almost ran her over about 12 times. We'd get by the lakeshore and I'd just start walking.
So this all started in 2009, is that right? Was that your first tour? Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Think about it.
I know. It sounds crazy when you say it out loud. But at the end of each adventure, I thought, this can't be the only one. You know, I've had so much fun. I've learned so much, and I love to learn new things. So with each adventure, it opens up new knowledge about the Great Lakes, which I love so much.
But this all is coming to an end.
It is a trilogy. Yeah, yeah. And these three books take you on a journey from one Great Lake to all five Great Lakes and then to the islands. So by reading the three, you'll get an evolution and progression of the entire Great Lakes Basin. And I think to do a fourth adventure would be starting to repeat myself or not have something that's new and fresh for a fourth book, and I don't want to bore my readers. So this will be the final piece of the trilogy of my Great Lakes adventures.
When you think of the plovers,
piping plover,
and the research that you're about to help with, what difference can that make?
Well, the piping plover research is not just observation. They also locate the nests and cover them with an exclosure. It's not an enclosure. It allows the parent birds to get in and out, but it keeps predators out. So the hatching success for that species has skyrocketed because of that intervention. So that was wonderful to be part of actively saving a species because they are on the endangered list. And they are little tiny birds. Every once in a while, a little tiny one would get too close to the waves and I'd want to jump in and save it, but it would be fine. They're fine. regarding the moose and wolf study, climate change is affecting that island. And with the wolves dying down, Someone brought a dog to the island several years ago that had parvovirus, and that really knocked down the wolf population. And then that population is quite inbred because it's on the island and the ice bridge had not formed for over a decade, a couple decades.
Oh, so over the decades, they had been back and forth, so the packs were
in the past
healthier.
New individuals could make it to the island.
Yeah.
But this year, there was an ice bridge that formed, and they were hoping for an infusion, a genetic infusion, by having some wolf wander onto the island. But actually, it ended up that one female wolf left the island. So they lost an individual. And when the wolf population dies down, the moose population takes off. There's over 1,000 moose on the island now. And they'll eat some species of trees into extinction on that island, and then they'll start to starve. So you just see the balance of life is so tenuous on these islands, especially for land mammals. I mean, birds are different. They can come and go. Bats can come and go. But land mammals are kind of stuck there unless there's an ice bridge.
So you could compare it to we humans stuck on our maybe big islands
we could.
That are constantly...
If you want to make that leap, please do. Yeah, it's kind of the world ends small, you know, and you see how tenuous life can be. How fragile. There are some plants on Isle Royal that exist nowhere else in the world. Things develop and evolve in isolation and set up a balance with the species around them.
So, Lorene, your background, you worked in the medical, you're in research, you worked in a hospital setting.
Yes,
so the science...
Cancer research.
Yeah. So science and dissecting how ecosystems work. You've got the scientific brain to sort of pick that apart.
Yeah, and I'm able to read scientific papers and make that information accessible to readers who don't have a Master of Science like I do. And I enjoy that. I enjoy digesting all that information.
Did writing itself come naturally to you? I mean, you mentioned that you've also written a novella. You have several books under your belt. Did that all start just... Does it flow?
Well, I did go back and get an MFA in writing in 2007. I started getting serious about my writing, and I did that. I did not expect to do these adventures and write nonfiction, though. I love writing literary fiction, and I still write literary fiction. I have a lot of short stories that have been published, and I have a novel that's out. Hopefully, it'll find a home soon. Writing is work, but the more you work at it, the easier it is, and the more it flows.
So what led to the decision to do an e-book for the first time?
So many people asked me at my events where to hike. Where can I take a 2-mile hike? Or where can I take a hike with 5 women all over 50 and one of them has a bad left knee? And I would have to think about where I was and what stretch of beach would be right for that specific group. So in this ebook, there are hand-drawn maps of my favorite 10 spots along Lake Michigan to hike. 3 of them are on this side of the lake. There's one in the Upper Peninsula. And then the rest are on the Michigan side. And it has a little description of what you might find there and why it's a special place. It also lets you know where you can park and how
Where's
far.
Where's the bathrooms?
Yeah, not too many bathrooms along the way. But it's just a nice thing to give people, and it's going to be priced very, very low, I think 99 cents. So it's just a nice resource for people. And people in Wisconsin should know that you have a wonderful stretch of fairly sandy beach between Kohler Andre and Harrington State Park. So between those two parks, it's walkable, and not much else is walkable along Wisconsin's shoreline. But that's a beautiful stretch. Now, that's a long stretch. There is a small county park in the middle. I can't remember the name of that, but that's... I mean, you can always hike up for a ways and then come back to where your car is if you don't want to do the complete 15 miles.
When Lorene Nieuwenhuis isn't hiking or helping researchers count piping plovers, she writes and lives in Michigan. She spoke with environmental reporter Susan Bentz. Nieuwenhuis's e-book, Best Lake Michigan Hikes, comes out today. The final Great Lakes book in her trilogy is due in spring of next year. Meanwhile, she tells Susan Bentz more about her upcoming novel in a web exclusive at WUWM.com. a 21st century craftsman plying a 19th century trade right here in Milwaukee. We'll hear about it when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Blacksmithing brings to mind a lot of images, most of them out of history or myth, from the 19th century American West to Vulcan, the Roman god of fire. Most of us, if we think of a modern-day blacksmith, we might imagine someone who shoes horses. But while farriers are blacksmiths, not all blacksmiths are farriers. Kent Knapp is most definitely not a farrier. He is, though, a 21st century blacksmith who plies his trade right here in Milwaukee. Back in March, Lake Effect's Bonnie North stopped by his shop in the Third Ward.
Our motto here at Milwaukee Blacksmith is get it hot and hit it hard.
The hot metal gives in to the force of Kent Knapp's hammer. He's making an ironwork scroll. He starts with a piece of 5/8-inch square steel about 3 feet long that he tucks into the glowing forge. Being the fanciful sort, I half expected to find Knapp working in a dark cave lit only by the glow of the fires and the sparks from the strike of the hammer on hot steel. But Knapp's blacksmith shop at the eastern end of the Third Ward is open and bright, the only shadows cast by the late winter sun that's coming through the large windows.
So I have two different forges burning here. One is a coal forge, which burns at about 3,000 degrees. Gets a small section of the bar really, really hot. But you got to be careful because it will melt in there. It's just a coal fire with air blowing underneath it, just like when you blow on a campfire. The other one is a gas forge, which is just natural gas with air blowing over it. That gets to be about 1700, 1800 degrees.
Knapp has been smitten by smithing since he first walked into the Cedar Creek Forge in Cedarburg at the age of 19. He began studying with a Milwaukee master smith, but then he left Wisconsin with his family for a stint in New Orleans, a place that has its fair share of decorative ironwork, too. After 10 years away, the call home grew too loud to ignore, and Knapp returned, and more or less picked up where he left off. He's now in his 40s and making a go of Milwaukee blacksmith. And business is pretty good.
I do a lot of architectural pieces, gates, railings, balconies, fencing, sconces. I always say everything from a coat hook to a driveway gate. We can do just about anything with steel here. You know, if you want a piece that looks like it was made 120 years ago, we can do that. If you want to match some existing ironwork on your 100-year-old mansion, we can do that.
But even though there's great art and craft in the pieces that Knapp produces, he says it's tough being a blacksmith today.
There's a lot of fabricators out there, guys who will cut and weld stuff together.
Knapp points to the scroll that he's making now.
You can actually buy that stuff from China or India that was made by a blacksmith who makes 50 cents an hour. And you can buy, a C scroll or an S scroll out of a catalog for a couple of dollars and then weld it into your railing or your gate or whatever. I don't believe in that. I believe that anything that comes out of my shop should be made by me. So I will not use pre-made pieces that come from overseas. Everything that you see in my work is made by me.
Back at the anvil, the scroll is taking shape. Knapp changes to a smaller hammer, the better to do the finer finishing work. This piece is exactly the kind of thing that you'd learn how to make at one of Milwaukee blacksmith's public classes, although it would probably take you or me a lot longer to make, and to make well, than it does Knapp.
Just hammering it over the edge of the anvil, getting a nice curve. And these are just some basic techniques. A scroll is probably one of the most common elements in ironwork. You'll see it all over the place. Unfortunately, in recent years, you'll see more machine-made scrolls than handmade.
For all of his skill, Kent Knapp isn't just a good blacksmith. He's also a walking fount of ironworking history, especially about the part that Milwaukee played.
I love this craft. I'm crazy head over heels with it. I just think it's the coolest thing. I spend my hours studying it. And you combine that with my love for Milwaukee and the fact that we had this guy, Cyril Kulnick, here, which, in my opinion, was the best American blacksmith ever. There's a couple other guys that come close, but I just feel that he was the bee's knees, if you will. And we had him right here in Milwaukee for almost his whole life.
Austrian-born Kulnick moved to Milwaukee at the age of 20, and he set up shop here in the early 1890s. His award-winning decorative ironwork graced the homes of many of the city's prominent figures, including those of Frederick Pabst, Paula and Irwin Eline, and A.O. Smith, whose home is now the Villa Terrace Museum on Milwaukee's east side. One of Kulnick's masterpieces, a decorative grill, is still on display at the Villa Terrace. Knapp lights up as he talks about Kulnick's artistry, and I wonder if he hopes that someday his work will be revered in the way that he reveres Kulnick's.
I'm not sure. I do what I can. I'm constantly learning. I believe that each year I get better, so who knows where I might end up in my lifetime. But if I can ever be as good as Kulnick, I hope so. I feel he's so important, like I said, not only to the history of American blacksmithing, but to Milwaukee.
But even if Kent Knapp's name isn't remembered for generations to come, his ironworking legacy will live on. Knapp's kids are already learning the business, and he believes they'll be better than he is. Meanwhile, the scroll Knapp has been working on is almost done. He sticks it into the forge to get it hot again, and then takes it to the anvil one last time.
True it up a little bit, make it straight. But anyways, you get the idea. That's the finished product. So in about 7-8 minutes, we went from regular square bar stock that comes out of the steel rolling mill. We tapered it out, did a little fishtail on there, and scrolled it over. Needed one more hit. One more hammer.
Does it always need one more hit?
It always does.
For Lake Effect, I'm Bonnie North.
Kent Knapp is the founder and owner of Milwaukee Blacksmith in the Third Ward. You can see a full slideshow of Knapp at work, including the scroll he was making and Bonnie North's feature at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Our feature first aired in March. That's all for the Wednesday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. So great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.